track came a hobo hiking, and he said, "Boys, I'm not turning. I'm headed for a land that's far away beside the crystal fountains. So come with me, we'll go and see the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, there's a land that's fair and bright, where the handouts grow on bushes and you sleep out every night, where the boxcars all are empty and the sun shines every day on the birds and the bees and the cigarette trees, the lemonade springs where the bluebird sings. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, in the Big Rock Candy Mountains, all the cops have wooden legs, and the bulldogs all have rubber teeth, and the hens lay soft-boiled eggs. The farmer's trees are full of fruit, and the barns are full of hay. Oh, I'm bound to go where there ain't no snow, where the rain don't fall, the wind don't blow, in the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, you never change your socks, and the little streams of alcohol come a-trickling down the rocks. The brakemen have to tip their hats, and the railroad bulls are blind. There's a lake of stew and a whiskey too. You can paddle all around them in a big canoe in the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, the jails are made of tin, and you can walk right out again as soon as you are in. There ain't no short-handled shovels, no axes, saws, or picks. I'm a-going to stay where you sleep all day, where they hung the Turk that invented work in the Big Rock Candy Mountains. I'll see you all this coming fall in the Big Rock Candy Mountains.
Okay, we have another great show for you today on the It's Going Down podcast. We have an exclusive interview with somebody from the Morgantown Ultra Left Network. It's a group of anti-authoritarian, anti-capitalists based out of West Virginia. We're going to be talking about what it's like in West Virginia. This was recorded right after the Trump election. So we're going to be talking about Trump. We're going to be talking about how they're not surprised that it went that way and about the kind of path that lies ahead for everybody. This is a great interview. They're also going to be talking about a big conference they have coming up at their school. So if you like what you hear, be sure to check them out online. We'll be sure to post links on the text for the podcast. So make sure to check out their website, check out the conference they have coming up, and we really hope you enjoy this, and we got a lot more coming. So please stay tuned and make sure to check out itsgoingdown.org for more updates, more podcasts, more articles, analysis every day that are coming your way only on itsgoingdown.org. Make sure to check us out on all social media platforms. If you can, please donate. You can find out more at itsgoingdown.org/donate. If you donate at least $20, you get a t-shirt. We'll send it straight to you. Without further ado, here's somebody from Morgantown Ultra Left Network. Thanks a lot.
Okay, so we're joined here today with Dina from Morgantown Ultra Left Network. We're going to be talking about the topic of the day, which is Trump winning the election, kind of what that means. Morgantown Ultra Left Network is situated in West Virginia, correct?
Yeah, we're in the city of Morgantown, which is in the northern part of the state.
Okay, so we're going to be talking about just, you know, Trump, just kind of his hold over the white working class, so to speak, in some areas, especially in rural ones. What this kind of means about Morgantown Ultra Left Network and what they've been up to, and also they have a conference coming up next year. So let's go ahead and get started. So how did Morgantown Ultra Left Network, that's MULN, I don't know if there's a catchy way to say that, but how did the group get started?
Yeah, the group Morgantown Ultra Left Network, the acronym is called MULN. We started, we've been organizing on the campus of WVU, West Virginia University, for about 4 years now. And in the last few years, a lot of us, you know, getting kind of closer to graduation, getting, you know, more invested in the community, decided that we wanted to sort of venture out of just sort of your standard organizing, like on campus, and actually sort of try to build an actual political project that, of course, encompasses the university. WVU takes up a huge amount of space in Morgantown, The student population is almost more, I think it might be more than the actual like residential population of Morgantown. So, you know, we wanted to just sort of break out and actually organize not just within the university, but also sort of against the university and in the community and try to like build connections and build something greater than just your sort of standard, you know, campaigns against like tuition increases. I mean, those are really important, but we wanted to connect, you know, the struggles against gentrification, the struggles for food justice, all those kind of things that happen in the community and connect them with university organizing.
So when you say organize against the university, that might catch some people as completely off. Like, you know, Bernie Sanders campaigned on giving everybody free tuition. So why would you want to be against the university?
You know, it can be kind of, a challenging thing at first when you first hear being, you know, against the university. Because I think for a lot of people, it's considered a very positive thing. But I think people sort of miss the mark when they talk about it. You know, there's something that there's an experience that we get out of education that I think is really valuable. I think people coming together and producing systems of knowledge production, I think are really, really important. And I think can give people a lot of, like, create a purpose in their life and can actually really enrich people. I think the big problem is, I think a lot of people in our group and others have sort of noticed, not just here, but you know, comrades in other places, that the institution of the university, you know, bound up in the state, bound up in capitalism, bound up in the reproduction of different forms of labor. You know, we found that the university is just as important as these other sort of institutions of society that reproduce these negative aspects. So we were pretty dissatisfied after, you know, being involved in things like the Million Student March and some of the other stuff that was going on over the last few years. You know, that stuff was good, and you know, I definitely would like to caution that, you know, I think it's obvious that if a politician, you know, if tuition became free in the United States, I would probably enjoy that. I think that would make people's lives a lot easier. But, you know, that's not really the point. The point is actually go after the university and say, well, maybe this whole institution itself is actually really harming us, and there are much, much better ways that we can sort of come together and experiment and create ways of education that don't have to be bound up in this institution.
So it's, you guys are targeting the university as a site of production and reproduction of capitalist society, right? Like in Communicate for an Absent Future, they say, you know, a free university is like a reading room in a prison.
Yeah. I mean, definitely something that I think a lot of us agree with. I mean, the university here, at least, I think a lot of people can speak to this at their universities. It's almost like education kind of comes second. You know, like, you know, at least with our university, we have a president called Gordon Gee, who's kind of famous because he's one of the first sort of professional college presidents. He's not sort of a man from an education background. He's not like a famous politician that became a president of the university. He's sort of a professional. He treats universities like a CEO. He has done this at many universities. And, you know, I think our experience here and having a president like that really showed us the sort of probably the worst of what a university can be. And in seeing that, you know, seeing wages being cut, seeing people being reproduced. I mean, a lot of us were, and I think a lot of people have this experience of, you know, wanting to go to grad school and all this kind of stuff. And then you sort of see your friends and you see a lot of people who enter grad school and it doesn't change. Your wages are low. They'll pay you shit. You know, hours are long and hard. And then even if you can get a job in the institution, you know, it's probably not going to be very fruitful. Your hours are long. You know, these jobs are, like, not available. They're extremely competitive. You know, what is sort of told to us is, like, oh, this sort of grand university where, like, anything is possible. The second you enter in, I mean, it's obvious that it's not. It's obvious that most of the people involved in this are obviously suffering and not having a good time. I mean, most people have the experience of, you know, running into a professor and they're completely busy. They have no time for their family. They don't enjoy their work, even though they've trained their whole lives to do this stuff. They're completely alienated from their entire labor and have no, at least from what I've seen, have almost no enjoyment. And that seems wrong. It seems like education or but wanting us to come together and produce systems of knowledge is really important. But it seems like the institution of the university keeps getting in the way of that. And I think we really want to challenge that.
If you look at, you know, the people that are working at the university, you know, minus basically professors that are tenured or, you know, maybe people in management or administration positions, you know, especially the service workers are always paid very horribly, usually cannot afford to, or, you know, most definitely cannot afford to send their kids to school there. They can't afford to go there themselves. You know, usually they can't even afford to live in the same towns of where they're working at. And then you have, you know, adjunct professors that are, shifting around from university to university, taking up a course here and there. And then, of course, the students, which are by and large, a lot of people are working jobs and they're racking up massive amounts of debt.
Yeah, I mean, at our university, you know, West Virginia has a program. It's a land-grant university, so the university is supposed to sort of, you know, it's sort of supposed to be there for the state, and it's supposed to be attracting students from West Virginia. You know, West Virginia is obviously an extremely poor place. I'm from West Virginia. I think anyone from West Virginia or even the greater Appalachian area knows what that's like. Whether you're in a more urban part, you know, Morgantown's a much more urban space within Appalachia. I don't think people realize that. You know, people don't really think of urban sort of spaces existing in Appalachia, but, you know, there they exist. WVU is supposed to be the school for students from this region, and it's supposed to be a place you can come. You know, they have a thing called the Promise Scholarship, which, of course, they cut back year after year, but, you know, a lot of students have this opportunity to go here for nearly free for a lot of students, and that should be a boon, but it's not. I mean, it's obvious that students come up here, they're worked to death, they're put in the ringer, people having to go through, you know, the sort of student jobs and all that stuff, which actually prevents them from learning. All these things seem to be going against learning, and that's a huge problem. And, you know, most of the people that are educated at WVU end up leaving the state anyway, so all these sort of schemes to try to help the region don't actually work. And again, you know, in talking about the university reproducing capital, I think a good example is with WVU, they have a giant private foundation. They've bought up huge amounts of land. They use that foundation to funnel public money into private contractors, the majority of which are rich alumni from the university. They build these giant apartments, which they force students to buy, rent. These have exorbitant fees. You know, they knocked down huge amounts of housing that was, you know, the housing stock, and now there's all this housing that's limited just for students. It's caused a massive homeless problem within our region. It's made rents go up by $100, $200 within a year time. The gentrification in Morgantown and a lot of places in Appalachia is actually quite extreme, but a lot of people wouldn't think of that. But the WVU has been a big pusher of that, and I think we see that in a lot of other cities. People I've talked to, particularly like in Philly, with, you know, Temple University buying land, and, you know, this is a big way that capital can move into areas where it hasn't been.
Well, let's talk about the conference you all have coming up next year. It's NAPER, right? Can you just tell people about what's going to happen and what the overall arching goals of the conference are?
Yeah, it's called the In the Institution Convergence. It's imposing university and all sites of control. We've, as a group, have hosted conferences in the past. They were kind of just general sort of leftist gatherings. They were kind of fun, but they weren't really fruitful. It didn't feel like anything was actually produced. So with that in mind, you know, going into this, we're moving to a convergence model and a clear goal. We want to call out and bring people together who have either, you know, are in university currently struggling, people that have been in the struggle against universities in the past, people that have an interest in fighting capital, fighting the state, people that are interested in having an offensive stance against the university. And I think, you know, with abolition kind of being a popular term, a popular concept, and anarchists and just the general left below at this current moment, we really want people to start thinking in terms of abolition, not just with prisons, not just with other sort of state mechanisms, but also the university. The university, in a lot of ways, is something that's a bit coveted by, I think, the left at times. It's a place we can find refuge in. But, you know, the places that radical leftists can find refuge in, let's say, a Berkeley or MIT or some of the other universities that might you know, give them positions, new school, things like that. You have to look, and, you know, these schools are wrapped up in, they get all the same kind of funding from the state. They get, they, you know, are involved in the production of capital, just like any other university, even if they're a refuge for leftists. So we need to critique that. We need to say, no, we're not going to be part of this. We need to say, no, we need to propose an alternative. We'll be having workshops, breakout. It's going to be a two-day event, April the 8th to the 9th. It's going to be on the campus of WVU. We have a website. It's called intheinstitution.wordpress.com. We just posted our registration page, so if you're interested in coming, please register. We're going to be providing food and housing, as much housing as we can. We will be providing food for free at the event. And one of the big goals is, because I think that there have been very similar moments of attacking the university in the last, let's say, decade, particularly in the United States. I think Europe has a longer history of this. Want to do is actually come together and produce some kind of working document, actually come together and produce a plan, come together and actually talk about what are steps we can take to actually attack the university directly, while at the same time proposing alternatives, and you know, whether they be inside the university themselves or outside of the university, and actually trying to get some groundwork laid and potentially have this to be a recurring event. We're also working closely with some comrades in Pittsburgh, Pittsburgh Student Solidarity Coalition. They're a really cool organization at Pitt. So yeah, I mean, that's sort of the gist of the convergence. It's kind of, it's definitely in its early stages right now, but please register, because, you know, we want to make sure that everyone can have housing and we can provide. Our website is in the institution at wordpress.com. We're just encouraging people to register because, you know, we want to make sure we can house everybody. We want to make sure that everybody who wants to come can come. So we just want to encourage people to register so we can make sure everything is provided for. We're also going to be providing child care and stuff like that. So we really want to encourage lots of different people to come to this.
Awesome. That's great to hear. Well, let's switch gears a little bit. Let's talk about West Virginia. Let's talk about Trump. You know, before we started recording, we were talking about how you are not surprised that Donald Trump won. Explain your thoughts and why. And, you know, what's it like on the ground in West Virginia, and why do you think it swung that way?
Yeah, you know, within West Virginia, I'm not surprised that Donald Trump won. You know, this is a state that Bernie also won in, so I think that any sort of politician that had a explicitly sort of populist message was going to do well. Most of the counties in our state went 60, 70, some 80% Trump. So it's definitely an uphill battle for any leftist, really, in West Virginia, but particularly anarchists. You know, I think it's definitely an uphill battle, but I think it's doable. There is, if there is, you know, I've always felt if there is a place that some really, really strong resistance movements could be built, a place that the state and capital doesn't have its eyes as glued to, a place that there is a freedom of movement, it's definitely in West Virginia. So I encourage people not to discredit it as a place that radicals can come from. There's a really strong radical history to the state. You know, it's an uphill battle here, but I'm not surprised, particularly on our campus. We have a pretty conservative campus at WVU. If you could walk around campus, and it was obvious that, you know, Donald Trump had a pretty strong support on campus. When Bernie was running, there was a presence on campus. But the second that ended, everybody went to Clinton, and people became wholly disinterested. A lot of projects, which were being backed by Bernie people on campus, completely fell apart when that happened. So it really demobilized a lot of things when Bernie conceded and went to Hillary. So kind of in a rebuilding phase when it comes to resistance. However, with Trump, there's been a renewed sort of call to resistance. Even today, we've gotten contacts from 10, 20 people talking about getting involved. So hopefully we can rebuild and stuff after that. But yeah, our campus is quite conservative, so I'm not surprised that, you know, Trump has a big influence in this region.
It's interesting that the areas that swung to Bernie, you know, ended up going to Trump. And I just think that shows that people are so fed up with the Democrats and just so want an alternative that they're willing to basically go towards so far to the right. I just wondered if you could comment more on that. You were talking about how some of the Bernie people, you know, lost steam after he dropped out and, you know, went towards Clinton.
You know, there was a pretty large Bernie group, you know, and we had been building some projects in regards to independent student union and some other projects going as well on campus. And the session that Bernie conceded, the Bernie group was dissolved, almost formed and became, you know, and, you know, they all sort of returned to being pro-Clinton stuff on campus. And most of the sort of broader mobilizations that were occurring around tuition and things like that on campus were completely halted. Events that in the first semester last year, which could bring out 100 to 200 people, completely collapsed and could only bring out 20 to 30. We saw this with the Million Student March. That was a big event around you know, the country a year ago. But when they called a second event, you know, as Bernie was sort of trickling down or had already conceded, you know, that completely fizzled out, you know. So that's always been an uphill battle is, you know, when you get this sort of, when you get a Democrat populist, you know, it can definitely whip people up. But the second that person goes away, the air is sucked out of the room. You know, so we're sort of rebuilding, at least in that front. But we have a lot of interest in sort of an anti-political stance, you know. I think a lot of people are completely, at least on this campus, I would assume others, minimally people are expressing a very deep anti-political stance, which we think is really productive. People being like, well, I'm not going to vote. And we saw that from a lot of people. You know, that's anecdotal, but a lot of people broadly that we know just refuse to vote. And I think that's a really good move. That is, I think that's a good sign. I think people are open to political actions outside of what is considered acceptable, what is considered civil. And I think that's a good move forward. Yeah,
I completely agree. I think that's one of the biggest things now is to basically point and say, like, you know, look, the electoral left is a total and complete failure. And, you know, it's totally failed everyone, you know, and the only path left is in the streets. The only path left is through revolutionary action. And to do the things that, you know, the union bureaucrats and the Democratic Party politician heads and, you know, the people that control, you know, huge activist groups like 350.org or nonprofits or whatever have been basically trying to manage and destroy, you know, you know, they're as much part of the problem as Trump is.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, we would tend to agree. Those traditional routes just seem to not be producing the things we want to produce. You know, it's good to note, I think, you know, MALN, Morgantown Ultra Left Network, is very, very probing in the streets. I think that's definitely where we find ourselves most of the time. You know, with this convergence, again, I think it's really good to be in the streets. But I definitely think that one of the goals we want to have is to actually begin to produce and propose alternatives. So in saying no to the university, producing a general refusal to all of these institutions, you know, people are going to say, well, what are you going to do? And I think we need to really think about that and try to say, okay, if we are against the university as an institution, but at the same time, we do value producing knowledge, because we can see its enrichment of people, well, what do you do then? And I think that's something we really want to explore and begin to sort of kick in motion with this convergence.
Yeah, I meant in the streets very broadly. I meant basically anything that isn't basically putting it back into politics, you know, outside anti-political, community-based, you know.
Yeah.
Focused on our workplaces, neighborhoods, and schools and all that stuff. Well, more on the Trump thing, how do you see in the next couple of years, you know, basically organizing in those areas that went so hard for Trump and trying to basically, you know, toe a class line, essentially, and trying to get those people to see that, you know, immigrants and Black Lives Matter activists and Muslims necessarily aren't your enemies. Your enemies are, you know, the people that own everything and control our lives.
Yeah, it's tough, right? I mean, there is, you know, at least on our campus, there's a Black Lives Matter movement. However, here it's extremely, extremely conservative. It's very unfortunate seeing, even in other sort of maybe smaller, well, no, we don't have a small university, but seeing in other places that are not as populous like us, you know, other places have lower populations. They still have Black Lives Matter movements that at least were pushing to some degree. Here, it's pretty much completely subsumed under the sort of accepted organizations like NAACP and groups like that. And it's not only is, I mean, there is a complete and utter lack of action. And when there are marches, they openly organize with the police and thank the police for being there and stuff like that. So it can be a pretty almost like neutering experience, like when you're there and you're trying, and like people, it's obvious that people want to push and people want to sort of get the, you know, get the ball moving, but we can't because people have to say, you know, they like the police, and you know, you'll get yelled at if you even sort of, if a Trump, you know, we had one experience where there's a Black Lives Matter march and a Trump supporter drove by shouting anti-black stuff at everybody, and somebody yelled at them, yet they were sort of, the crowd sort of said, no, don't yell at Trump supporters. So, you know, we have to battle through that, even getting not even violent action, but getting people okay with even sort of shouting back and saying no. And so that's going to be a struggle on campus. You know, more broadly, the sort of questions of the white working class, you know, that's a really tough one. You know, it's a majority white state. I don't have all the answers. I think that at least for us in Mullen, we really are going to be focusing on organizing within the sort of residential communities that are around the university. These communities have a mixed income. There are white working class people. There's people that work at the university. There's students of varying incomes. There are homeless people. This is like, and that's where we're really going to target, and actually sort of bridging the gaps between the university organizing community. You know, in a place like this, they're sort of intertwined. You can't really separate them out. The university has deep effects on the markets and capital within the region, yet the city also has effects on it. So I think a place we can intervene, at least, is with gentrification. That's affecting people, you know, regardless of race within this area. It's a thing that we can sort of pack and go on. Again, it's tough. But there's a radical history in West Virginia, right? So I think we also want to do that. We're very proudly Appalachian. We talk about that a lot. We don't beat around the bush about that. You know, and then also just organizing for ourselves. So in the sense of, like, we have a crew. It's obvious there are people supporting us, but we're going to have enemies. I don't have any sort of imagination or any idea that I'm going to convert these sort of, like, frat guys that are on campus that are virulently sexist, virulently racist, virulently pro-Trump. And you know, there are a lot of white workers, to keep it real, that we're not going to be able to get to. And that's, we have to accept that. So to some degree, we have to organize for ourselves in the sense of, like, if we have a strong crew, if we have a lot of people who are down, we need to be building institutions for ourselves so people can see that and say, oh, look at those people. They're actually, like, building alternatives. And so that's something we want to do here. Yeah,
I totally agree with you. And, I mean, it's hard, too, because, like you said, I mean, we want to engage people and, like, work around certain things and, like, bring people in. But like you said, at the same time, like, there's some people that are never going to come to our side. Like, they're just our enemies. You know what I mean? There's no other way to, like, slice it.
And that's a challenge, right? Because I, you know, something we talk about, at least in the communique that we put out, is, you know, a lot of times I think people think of these sort of issues as, like, the example of, like, a French salon. It's just, we're on this equal footing and we're sort of having this conversation and one person's going to win out. But I think if you look at the field of politics, what happens in your community, that's obviously not true. It's obvious that these communities that we're constructing, you know, there's the community of Morgantown, but what is the actual community? Well, there's enclaves of student housing. There is, like, trailer parks. There are obviously neighborhoods that are extremely wealthy that have nothing to do with the trailer parks, you know, a mile down the road from them, right? There are racial divides that are intense. West Virginia, you know, is a state that, you know, people always call it, it's a white state. But there is a historically important black community that's always lived here. They tend to be more concentrated around the world, urban centers like, you know, like Morgantown, like Charleston, like Huntington. They get scapegoated for a lot of things. But that's a real important part of this state. And in calling this state a quote-unquote white state, you sort of erase these people. I think that's something that we want to fight against, is the sort of, historical erasure of queers and non-white people within West Virginia. You know, Mullen is a very queer-centric group. Appalachia has a history, has a queer history, and we want to express that. You know, in expressing that queer history in West Virginia, it's obvious that we're going to turn off a lot of these quote-unquote white-collar workers. At a point, I don't care as much. You know, I want to organize with the people that I want to organize. I have preconceived notions that I'm going to convince every homophobe and transphobe that, like, my life, you know, is tangible and real. So, yeah.
Can you talk a little bit on, you said you're proud to be from Appalachia. Can you just expand upon that?
Yeah, I mean, something we've talked about in a former communique that we put out through the Filler Collective in Pittsburgh is we don't want to romanticize Appalachia. I think a lot of people end up falling into that. In trying to reclaim Appalachia, they sort of romanticize it. You know, Appalachia is a fiction. It's not like like most territories, it's not this real place. It's not like inscribed on the ground. There is a region that we generally call Appalachia. It's a settler region. You know, there were Native people here. There are Native people here currently. We have to grapple with that. You know, there's a historical Black population. When people think about Appalachia, they don't think about Black Appalachians. Yet there's Black Appalachians, and we have to grapple with that. We have to grapple with those histories. Yet at the same time, it is a real place that a lot of people, you know, talk about. It's a fiction. People have histories here, and their families have lived here. There's a strong union history here. There's a militant union history here. There's a history of directly confronting the coal bosses, you know, directly confronting the capitalist class and saying no, and not just confronting, but fighting with weapons. You know, that's a real history. So I'm very proud of that in some sense. However, I also know I'm aware it's not like a nation. It's not this coherent place, right? It is an incoherent place, but I'm still proud of being from this sort of wild, incoherent place.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. Yeah, it's interesting. I was talking to somebody else that works on IGD the other day, and we're laying out a new issue of the It's Going Down magazine. We were saying how inspiring it's been that so much has happened in the South and the Southeast in the past year. And I think that a lot of us get caught up in looking to these big urban centers like Oakland or wherever else, or, you know, big cities, and kind of gloss over everything that's happened rurally in the United States in the past year. I mean, especially with what's going on in North Dakota right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people, when they think of West Virginia, they do not think of radical organizing. So, you know, when we've showed up to different events and met people and conversed, and we tell them about our crew and our organizing, I think people can be surprised at times. But, you know, I think as Appalachians, we're pretty used to getting ignored. so it doesn't hurt us too much, I guess. But, you know, if people are looking for land projects, if people are thinking about doing ZAD-like projects, I mean, I can't think of any other place in this region that is suitable. I mean, this place, the kind of farming, the kind of small-scale communal farming you can do, the kind of commune building I think is possible here is almost unmatched. That could be my own, you know, me being from here. I originally was born in Arizona, but my mom's family's from here. I've grown up most of my life here. Most of the members of our crew have grown up here. So we have a deep connection. And, you know, again, we're talking about the radical history. That radical history is not even just from the 1910s. I mean, there are very famous battles that happened here in the early and mid-2000s against mountaintop removal, you know, by Earth First. You know, those people threw down. There's groups like RAMPS, Radical Action for Mountain and People's Survival in West Virginia. That is an amazing group. They come out of those fights. You know, they came out of those fights. You know, they're doing a lot of great work on the pipeline stuff. You know, they have really good work, you know, they're doing really great organizing here in the southern part of the state. You know, there is a recent history here as well of organizing. So people shouldn't count out West Virginia and Appalachia. I think that's some of the most experimental, interesting, fun sort of alternatives are going to be produced here. And I'm really glad to be part of that.
Great. I mean, how do you see the future just in that area of anarchists and other revolutionaries linking up in that area and starting to work more together? How do you see that in the coming years? Do you think that's going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, we've done it here. I mean, like, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, there was no scene here. And, you know, now there is a scene. There is a group of people that people know. There is a group of people that are doing, that is doing work. And not just doing work here, but also reaching out both in the state itself and in our region. There's just a lot of great work happening. I don't see it stopping. I think with the Trump presidency and just the climate it is, and just, you know, I think our own, our own efforts here are trying to distribute literature, trying to get people aware of anti-political action outside of that sort of accepted thing, non-party action. I mean, you know, that's the thing you have to struggle with, because a lot of people that are getting into leftism and are getting into radical politics, you know, a lot of times the first thing is like, oh, what party should I join? You know, I think a lot of people in our crew went through that. You know, so that's always the kind of thing. You know, a lot of the sort of alternatives that are going to be built are going to be party-based. I'm not into that. We're going to have to deal with that and figure out ways to kind of either work around that or work with those people, I think, at times. But yeah, I think anarchism and a living, breathing anarchy is definitely possible here. It is going to be built here. Yeah, I definitely think that's true.
How do you see in the next, because it's obvious that, it's already happening, you know, last night, today, there's people on the streets, there's clashes happening with the cops, you know, there's demonstrations being called against Donald Trump. How would you see us progressing forward without falling into this trap of like, well, in 4 more years, we'll have, you know, a great Democrat in office?
It's always tough. I just tell people to look at what it's gotten. At least for me, I haven't gotten anything out of any of these presidents. I don't think most people have. If you have, you should probably look at it and, like, think about your social position if you are benefited by these presidents and what they do. It's just a tough one. There was a big push a few months, so early in this year, to pass a right-to-work law. It did end up passing.
Can you explain what a right-to-work law is?
Yeah, a right-to-work law is they originated in the Jim Crow South, but they're pretty much laws that make union organizing really hard. So, under closed shop rules, if you joined a shop that was a union shop, you know, that's a supermarket, you were automatically enrolled in the union. Now they can't automatically enroll you. You have to wave and say, no, I want to be enrolled. And so what you see is you have immediately large drop-offs of people in unions. People aren't in unions anymore. They don't pay dues. The unions lose any strength. Not to say that the big sort of official unions are great. They're not. But, you see massive drops in unionizing. And West Virginia is traditionally an extremely strong union state. It is very union proud, if anything. We were fighting that, and it seemed like action was being built. You know, you'd go to events, and you would hear, like, bluegrass, like, you know, carpenter workers talking about, like, maybe we could do sabotage. And, like, you just hear these little things in the crowd, and you're like, wow, like, people are really fed up. They really hate the governor. They really hate the state legislature. Stuff's going to go down. We had a rally. It was the last anti-right-to-work rally, and the sort of union officials came out, and their big slogan was, remember in November, like, you know, don't vote, or don't, you know, don't strike, don't picket, don't do anything. Remember in November, we'll vote our guys in. And as you see in West Virginia, we now have Jim Justice, who's another billionaire. He's a Democrat. He's a billionaire. He supports Donald Trump. So we have a Republican legislature that's pro right to work. So that whole remember in November thing didn't pan out. If anything, it led to a Trump victory. So I'd point people to that and say, look, you keep doing this, and if anything, it's actually making worse. Look, we have alternatives. A lot of us in law like to point people to Rojava in Syria. I think a lot of us feel like, how does Rojava relate to West Virginia? Well, let's look at their model. I don't think the economic model being put there is, like, any way perfect. You know, I'm an anarchist. I have commitments to communism and realizing, you know, a moneyless, classless, stateless society. However, you know, I look at places like Rojava and see the sort of cooperative, you know, model that's being in place and how people are building workers' cooperatives and actively building their own structures. And I see that, and I, you know, like, that's a proposal. When I tell people in Western Day, like, look at what these people here are doing in a hyper-marginalized place, a place that's been historically marginalized, right? Like, there was a retreat that occurred, you know, and they instituted the things they wanted to do as a community. And, like, that's something we should be thinking about here in the States, you know, looking to other places like, as I say, the Zad. And, you know, Rojava, being like, okay, what are they doing there that we could import here? Not everything is going to translate, of course, but, you know, there are real economic models being built in Rojava, and there's documentation on that. We should be looking at that and trying to, you know, when people ask us what is an alternative, we can be like, look at this documentation. We know that the workers' cooperatives here have these mechanisms in place to, you know, they have mechanisms in place to decrease capital over time within workers' cooperatives. So they take, you know, workers' cooperatives that still deal with the money, and within a few year time, you know, they plan to have them be pretty much moneyless. I think, like, that's a real cool thing we should be learning from.
Yeah, I would agree. Well, thanks for joining us today. Is there anything else you want to add, or where should people go if they want to learn more about the conference, or if they want to learn more about Morgantown Ultra Left Network?
Yeah, to learn more about the conference, we have a blog up for updates. We just posted our registration page. It's called intotheinstitution, .wordpress.com. And we also have produced a few communiques, and those have been published in the Filler Collective. They do a zine in Pittsburgh, so just look up Filler Collective, and we have our communiques in there. And we also have a Twitter.
Well, this has been a great conversation. Thanks for joining us. I mean, it's great to hear about stuff happening in West Virginia. I hope it continues. I hope you all are able to spread out and meet more people, you know, at the university and beyond. And this is just the start. We have a lot of work ahead of us, but I'm glad you all are along for the ride.
All right. Thanks. I appreciate it.
Cool. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Once again, we're at the very end. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for Morgantown Ultra Left Network for joining us as well for that in-depth conversation about what's going on in the one, the only West Virginia. Thanks a lot. At the beginning of the podcast, we heard the Big Rock Candy Mountain with a hip-hop remix. We're going to hear Appalachian Terror Unit, one of my favorite anarcho-punk bands out of Appalachia. So if you want to support this work, if you want to see it grow and expand, please go on itsgoingdown.org/donate. Sign up to become a monthly sustainer. $5, $10, $20, anything helps us. Please sign up to donate. If you donate 20 or more, you'll get a t-shirt sent your way. If you want to just give us a one-time donation, hey, that's great too. We've got a lot more stuff coming. This is a brand new microphone we're recording on. All our new podcasts will be recorded on this mic, so we really hope you enjoy. We hope it increases the quality. Thanks for everybody that stuck with us. I think this is about almost the 20th episode we have so far. We're turning these out every couple days. And again, if you want to be on a podcast, please email us at info@itsgoingdown.org. You can also check us out on all social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Please like us, share our stuff. And until next time, we'll still be here. We know you will be. We can't wait for what's coming around the corner. We got a lot of stuff planned. Thanks for sticking with us. It'sgoingdown.org. We'll see you in the streets.